Welcome. This is the third and last session on the Book of Ruth. If you were expecting something else, we can all close our eyes and you can leave without being embarrassed. But otherwise, you're stuck here for the... if you're in the wrong place or you need to leave early, don't worry about that at all.
Is it going to make sense if we miss the first two?
It will.
Okay.
It will. I'll certainly... How many are here for the first... Oh, that's interesting. Right. That's good, because this last session we're going to get into the meat of the story. And so I think that'll... I'll tell you what we have done. For those of you who are here for the first time, this is part of a project that we're working on back home in Ireland. You may have heard that we have our own little local difficulties known as Brexit. And that's Brexit, which is the UK's vote to come out of Europe, which is causing untold confusion and inactivity and has totally gummed up the works in government. But the other impact of Brexit is that issues and relationships that we thought we had resolved through the peace process in Northern Ireland, the tensions have begun to rise again because of Brexit.
Oh.
Because Brexit is all to do with relationships and borders. So the possibility, for instance, of a border having to be, a hard border having to be put onto the island of Ireland again after having been without it now for 30 years, is raising the tensions in our own peace process. We're conflicted about borders, about difference and diversity, about who constitutes the other on the island, about our relationships on the island of Ireland between North and South, Protestant and Catholic, between the islands of Ireland and Great Britain, and obviously then those relationships across into Europe. And all of these things are being overlaid with the tensions created by Brexit. And we found that the churches aren't talking about this at all because it's too complicated. So faith communities are not getting engaged and it's too complicated, and they know that their congregations are divided, so clergy are staying away from it. And actually both governments approached us and made this comment to us within a week or two of each other that there had been no official comment from faith groups, particularly the Christian groups on the island. So we took on to maybe help make those conversations happen. So for the past two or three months, we've been travelling up and down the island of Ireland, north and south, and over in England, Scotland and Wales, having conversations about the Book of Ruth. It has been our route in to those conversations, and it's been a really powerful resource for us in getting these conversations about difficult matters.
Approached you?
Both governments, the Irish government, and also the devolved government of Northern Ireland.
Okay.
Just in meetings we were having, they mentioned this, and we said, well, we might be able to do something about that. So we've taken on, and we'll write a report up on these conversations when we're done. Yes, I will give more details on that in the end. I'm part of a community organisation called Corrymeela, which is the oldest peace and reconciliation organisation in Ireland. Not a much smaller scale version of Poland, but there's considerable overlap between the two organisations. Sorry, that's a good question. And we write a report for the governments when we're done with this. And so we've been meeting lots of particularly lots of church Christian groups and having these conversations. And when we were invited to come over to Holden, and there were two of us here last week and I'm here this week, we wondered, maybe there's nothing happening over in the United States that requires difficult conversations. And we might fall flat on our face. And people will say, what are you talking about? This country is wonderful and we're in great shape and our politics is so civil and, you know. But we suspected there might be worthwhile. And so it has proved. In our first session, we didn't get any further than the first five verses of the Book of Ruth, which talks about famine, which talks about people fleeing famine across borders, which talks about encountering others who are different, others about whom we have particular stereotypes that go back many, many centuries. We're talking about, in this case, in the Book of Ruth, it's the Moabites. And Israel has a long history with the Moabites, most of which is negative. And there's a lack of trust and a lack of relationship. The three things about them are you can never turn to Moab in a crisis because they'll not help. You need to be very careful about Moabite women. And actually, as a whole people, they're not to be trusted. They began in unseemly fashion and they still can't be trusted. So we talked about that process of othering and how we demonize people who are different when we encounter them, and how quickly, as we found in our own circumstance in Northern Ireland, how quickly when you demonize another people group, how easily and quickly you can move to violence against that group. And we need to be conscious of that and not to fall blindly into situations of violence that happen before we know it. And that was our opening session. As I said, that was our first five verses. The second session we looked about the importance of paying attention to what's going on around us, the importance of noticing and being able to read our times, and the importance particularly of liturgy amongst those of us who profess faith, how liturgy and spirit and the practice of Christian faith helps shape us for encounter with these kind of challenges. And we talked about different ways in which the arts play a role in sensitizing us and helping us pay attention to notice what's going on. And in the story, we looked particularly in Jewish tradition how the Book of Ruth is always read, which seems to be a small, contained, local story about widowed women in particular situations of need, and how this, on the surface, small, contained, personal story is read in Jewish tradition and in Jewish liturgy alongside the great, big, world-shaking events of Sinai. And we spent a little bit of time investigating why these two things would live together side by side. What is the liturgy trying to teach us about the use of this story? And suggested that actually, since the Exodus 19 and 20 is about the giving of the law, that the Ruth story, this small, local and contained story about vulnerable people, might conceivably be the proper lens through which to view the law of Moses. But actually all these laws given in the first five books of the Bible, particularly in books like Deuteronomy and Leviticus, maybe the Book of Ruth opens for us the possibility that all these laws are there not to define who's in and who's out, who belongs and who doesn't. But all of these laws are given, if we read it through the lens of Ruth, to ensure that there is kindness in the land. Because left to our own devices, that kindness will flee very quickly. And so we want to pick up that issue today to remind ourselves, I think, of the political importance of kindness, of the transformative power of kindness in the world and in our communities. And so we look at that. We're actually just going to walk through the final two chapters of the book of Ruth and notice where these things come up and see what transformation is worked by people who act in a kind fashion towards their neighbor. I'm talking about more than nice, because one of the things I've learned in my two visits to Holden, Lutherans are really, really nice. I'm talking about kindness, which is the next level. I'm sure you're kind as well, because kindness has real political and cultural power for transformation. One thing, the threads that's run through each of the sessions has also been the place of art. So we've actually used poetry in our sessions to sensitize us, to help us notice and pay attention. And today I want to play you two songs, one at the beginning and one at the end. I'm going to be a little bit self-indulgent. These are songs I love, but they're also songs by an artist from my hometown, which those of you, some of you were in the storytelling session just before this, is the town of Bangor in County Down, which, as I explained to the group, if you know anything about church history, it is absolutely irrefutably proven that the town of Bangor in the 5th, 6th and 7th century is the place, Bangor Abbey specifically, is the place credited with saving Europe from what was called, or what has been called, the Dark Ages. Do you know that in Bangor, Larry might know this, in Bangor, in the Abbey in Bangor, after the Roman Empire fell, and the monasteries were destroyed, and the universities and places of learning were destroyed, an abbey, because in Ireland we are so far to the periphery of Europe, this abbey survived. And as I said in the last session, from on the beach where I walk my dogs, monks regularly set sail, sailed up around the top of Scotland, and down the far coast, the east coast of Scotland and England, down into France. And then they walked across France, walked across Europe, planting new Christian communities and monasteries. And has anybody ever been to this town of St. Gallen in Switzerland? Well, that is historically, they say it was founded by St. Gall, who set out from Bangor, bringing the light of the gospel to Dark Ages Europe. So I'm really proud of Bangor. Yes, sir?
There's a book that describes that called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
That's exactly the book. That's exactly the book. I don't know if it's completely accurate, but I like to think it is. But it is true. And in Bangor, they developed a system of prayer, and which was a combination of monks and a whole, and several different choirs who would relieve themselves at different intervals so that they sang the hours, 24 hours a day for over 200 years, nonstop. Worship and prayer happened in Bangor Abbey. And there's just one wall remaining of the abbey still. And again, it's one of the places where I walk my dog. Anyway, all of that is by the by. Foy Vance is a singer, a songwriter, storyteller from my hometown. And at the start and end of today's session, I'm going to play a song by Foy. And both of these songs are storytelling songs, and they tell stories of kindness. And it's just to kind of soften us up as we begin to think about the transformative power of kindness. So the first one is called Gabriel and the Vagabond, and I hope you'll be able to see the lyrics, and I'm hoping, turn the volume up here, that this is audible when we begin.
Please hold her his hand. can see his eyes as the people walk by. Those they don't understand. You see, they just like he's gonna take them all. Go on, spread the word. That man stopped by and I saw a smile and said, as he gently whispered, hope. The trump started to cry, just kept saying, why, can't you see I'm the man? Well, I'm 32, and I've got this one pair of shoes, about tasting. I think it's clear to see that even God don't know what I believe in this way. Then gave me out to smile and said, you peace, my child. Salvation is here today. He got to his feet and he signed her to do. People turning around the street. He looked them in the eyes and he sang hallelujah. There's someone here you gotta meet. Someone you just gotta meet. When I'm out of bone, turn around with my son. Yeah, just smile. When he looked to the crowd, they were laughing at her like, but he could not see them for tears. When his vision came round, there was a young girl on the ground, and he knew she was fine as hard to come. No, she never was a fight until he lay beside her, gently. They got up to their feet and they sang hallelujah. People in the street, they were turning around. They looked them in the eyes and they sang hallelujah. There's someone here we have found. They sang hallelujah,
I've heard that song countless times in the 10 or 12 years or so that it's been released, and it still moves me deeply as I imagine that scene and that story of someone receiving blessing effectively and then in an extraordinary display of generosity and empathy reaching out with that same grace and transforming the life of another. An extraordinary act of kindness that causes not just a change in the circumstances of two individuals, but produces a change in those who are looking on as well. This is a community transformation, because one individual who received, had been the recipient of a kind act, moves that on. But we're interested in the book of Ruth. We're going to turn to the text in a moment. As I said, all we're going to do today is walk through the text and talk about it together. But essentially, this book of Ruth, for me, is nothing less than the reformation of tradition in Israel, the way things happen in Israel. It's about taking some of the traditional laws handed down over generations from Moses himself, and a recognition that these laws no longer fit the circumstances, or they result in some kind of unintended unkindness, so we'll change them. Specifically, there are three here: laws of inheritance and redemption, and then these laws of marriage. And just to quickly give you some of the background to these three laws. The laws of inheritance essentially are here. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, give his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative in his clan so that he may possess it. This is to have the force of law for the Israelites as the Lord commanded Moses. What do you notice about that law? What are you laughing? Why are you laughing?
It leaves the women out.
Surprisingly, apart from the daughter, this is a patriarchal society. The laws, the land is passed down through the men, essentially, or the living, a living daughter. Now, of course, when we come to the book of Ruth, because Naomi is the woman who has a kind of tentative appeal to land, because she was married to Elimelech, who was a landholder, but he dies. So the title will pass to their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they marry two foreign women, and then the two sons die. So there are no men left in Naomi's immediate family. There is some dispute about exactly what title she has. She has some title to land, but not securely, because the men are all dead. So the issue of Naomi's status needs to be resolved in the community. So this is one of the laws that needs to be clarified, it seems, for the sake of, in this case, the sake of Naomi and then Ruth. The second law is the law of redemption. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. So you've got farmland, it's passed down to you over the generations, but I'm just a lazy, poor farmer. And the land goes to seed, and I can't pay my bills. And so in order to survive, I can lease my land effectively, sell my land to somebody else. Now, there's a danger that that land then passes out of the family. So a next of kin can step in and buy that land back for me so that the land doesn't pass out of the family. And we'll see that working out in the story of Ruth. It's because land, the physicality, if you asked anybody in ancient Israel, how do you know God exists? They wouldn't make a philosophical argument. They wouldn't have a story about how God saved them from some peril. The guy or the woman would just take you by the hand, take you out into the field and say, that's how I know God exists. Because this land has come to me over the generations and has been preserved in our family. And God has blessed us through this land. So it was a tangible sign that you were part of the people of God. So if you lost your land, there was a very real sense in which you had fallen outside the people of God. So in a gracious, kind act, there was a law to allow somebody to buy it back for you, so that it didn't pass out of the family. Again, in the story, as we see it unfold, we'll see how that begins to work out. And the last one is this Levirate marriage, which is a curious thing. I just want to read this because we don't get enough sermons on this passage of the Bible. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. you read into that the obvious. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me." Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. And if he persists in saying, "I don't want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled." Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
I mean, it is a fantastically descriptive, you know, imaginative text of the scripture, and it just baffles me why it's not preached more. But I have no idea how you would preach it. But anyway, this will be unpacked a little bit in the story of Ruth as we go through, you'll see. But this idea that if you don't work to ensure that a family can keep hold of its connection to God, you will carry the stain of this nickname. Your family will carry that through the generations. It's great, isn't it? It's great. Right. So, this is like the opening few scenes of your favorite drama serial from years gone by, in which you get a recap at the start. First five verses, as we said, there is a famine and a family are forced to move across barriers because of famine. They settle there against all expectations and against all the stereotypes. They find a welcome in the land of Moab, and the sons of this family find faithful, good women to marry. But the men all die. In the first five verses, there's incredible death and incredible grief. 10 years they've been, and more, they've been in the land of Moab, when Naomi, who is the matriarch of the family, hears that God has blessed her home country and there is now food there, and she makes her mind, "There's nothing I've got here. I've no roots here. I'm going back home." In the heat of the hunt, one of the two daughters-in-law chooses to go with her, and they go back to Israel. And now the tables are turned. Naomi is home, but she comes home a changed woman. And Ruth, who had been a Moabite in Moab, is now a Moabite in Israel. And everybody and all the people she lives among, they know what a Moabite woman is like. So she has to live and survive in a country which has virtually no rules and regulations to look after the foreign women in particular. But she's back with Naomi, and they begin to make a go of it. She acts in Naomi's stead in a process they call gleaning, so traveling behind the harvesters and being able to lift what they drop. And that's how they survive in the first harvest season back home. And it just so happens she does this in the field belonging to a man who is a distant relative who could act to redeem this land, to redeem Naomi's land. Thing is, he's like many men who make all sorts of promises to women and then never fulfill them. And by the end of chapter 2, neither Naomi nor Ruth have much energy for the battle. They need Boaz, is the man's name, to step up, but he hasn't. And so Naomi concocts a scheme to get them on a more even keel. One day, we're just going to read this together. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you'll be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. Pause there for a minute. If it was your daughter you were speaking to, and you told her to wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes, maybe not your daughter, that's probably inappropriate. But you're looking at young women getting washed, putting on their best perfume and their best clothes, and going out at night. What are they going out for?
Meet somebody.
Yeah.
Pizza?
Pizza. Seriously. Now, yeah, you're going out to meet someone. Now, let me fill in a little bit of detail. I've highlighted the threshing floor. This is the end of the harvest. And at the end of the harvest, the men throw a party on the threshing floor. There's plenty of food and drink. And you can see there in verse 3, when he has finished eating and drinking. When Boaz lies down after that, we'll see as we read on, he's had plenty. And he lies down on the threshing room floor. Now, one of the things we know happens on the threshing room floor is that women, vulnerable women, come to the threshing room floor and they sell their bodies to the men who are at this party. That's what happens. And it seems obvious to me, and I'm happy to engage in a debate about it, seems to me that Naomi is encouraging Ruth to go down to the threshing room floor in her best gear to tempt Boaz. Now, we have a choice as we read this text. I think as we read on, it becomes quite obvious that sex is on the agenda here. Now, we can be offended in this good Bible story that sex is on the agenda, and quite deliberately as a tool. Or we can be offended by the fact that these are the lengths that some people have to go to just to survive. Let's read on. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant, Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." You see, in this part we read earlier, when he's finished eating and drinking, note the place where he is lying, go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. So she does it. Now maybe slightly inebriated Boaz, who falls into some kind of a drunken stupor, maybe he did wake up in the middle of the night because his feet were cold. But it's unlikely, particularly as some scholars would say that uncovering his feet should be in air quotes, that actually uncover his feet is a euphemism for uncover his penis. In other words, and In other parts of the text, the same ideas are used to imply sex. The thing is, when Boaz wakes, he is, I think, so inebriated. He doesn't even know if they have done the deed. And I don't think it was a polite, "Who are you? May I inquire after your name?" I think it was a drunken man waking out of his sleep beside a woman, wondering what has happened. This is lovely here. Firstly, you remember at the end of the passage we read earlier in the chapter, Naomi's advice to Ruth is, "Go uncover his feet, and when he wakes up, he will tell you what to do." I love this.
She tells him.
She tells him. She takes immediate control of the situation. She knows, because Boaz has made certain promises in the past, and he's made all sorts of pious aspirations. He's all sorts of pious aspirations for Ruth, none of which he's carried through on. This one is the main one, and it's almost like she throws it back to him and in an accusatory fashion, because in chapter 2, verse 12, I think, Boaz says a prayer in which he says, "May the Lord repay you for your kindness by spreading the corner of his garment over you." And Ruth says, "It's not enough that you push my need onto your God. You have the capacity to make the difference. You spread the garment. Be the answer to your prayers. You have a responsibility to me, Boaz." This is also interesting, because this really is the dramatic heart of the book of Ruth. She's not family. She's a foreign woman. She has no rights in Israel. She's certainly no rights to the land. But she has stepped in as the substitute for the broken and grieving Naomi. Everybody in chapter 2, both Boaz and he comments on part of all the people of the town, "We have all seen your kindness towards Naomi." And he uses a word, as we said in the last session, he uses a word there, which is a word mostly reserved for the work of God. And he uses this holy word, chesed, the loving kindness associated with God, and he uses it in association with a foreign woman. So everybody has seen the kindness of this woman. She's now daring him. "Am I just a good foreigner? Or am I family? Can I be treated with, you know, benevolence and goodness by the people of this town? Or will this town treat me as family?" Right at the heart of the drama of this chapter now. What will Boaz do? "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier." I sometimes wonder, what kindness is he talking about? Here's an older man with a much younger woman. "You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do all you ask." He's responding to this challenge about family. "All the people of the town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night." Now,
what?
That's exactly my question. "Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." my question is, like, this is just an aside. All the business has been conducted at that full stop. Ruth could go home. Stay here for the night. Lie here until the morning. It's colder. And, you know, you don't want to go home in the cold. But I think that means what it appears to mean. And I don't think we should be in any way prurient about it or embarrassed by it. It's what happens. So, he's made the promise. He will do what she said. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing room floor. Largely, no one must know you came to the threshing floor. He also said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. And when she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how did it go, my daughter? Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her. I love the intimate relationship between these two women. And added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. I've highlighted that passage because I think, both from a storytelling and a literary perspective, but also from just pragmatic action, I think this is just beautiful. No one must know that you came to the threshing room floor. He's already, I think, made up his mind that he's going to marry this woman as family. He also said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. I imagine she holds it out like this. And he pours barley into it. And she goes home carrying it like this. 2 things. One is, it changes her body shape, so as she's going home in the half light, no one will be able to fully be sure that this is Ruth. So her reputation as a good woman is preserved. She hasn't been to the threshing room floor. But also, what else does that suggest? Pregnancy. Isn't it a lovely literary addition, picture he has? It's almost as if he sends her home, and in the story there is a promise of what is to come in the shape of her carrying the grain. Or it's an indication in a literary fashion that after the night she already is pregnant. Mm-hmm. By the way, she told her everything Boaz had done and added, he gave me this barley saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. No, he didn't. But you know what? But you know, I just think Ruth is such, she's such an insightful woman, pastorally, in her commitment. She knows that the danger now is that Naomi is, instead of being inspired and being given hope and lifted up by this action, she could be driven further underground. And here she includes Naomi in the unfolding events. We never forgot about you, and Boaz is really keen to make sure that your family line is preserved. You're not being cut out here, Naomi. He's still... And look, my daughter... Transformation of Ruth has begun. But here we are, the end of chapter 3. We have the promises. But will he follow through? He hasn't before. Will he carry through on his obligations? And what about this foreign woman? She's done enough to be seen as a person of noble character. But is she family? Because currently, the law does not permit her to be considered family. Sorry, let me stop there for a minute. Any comment, reaction, reflection on any of this, agreements or disagreements? Yeah.
I'm just appreciating the strategy of her calling Boaz to task. Right? Some of it is that what you're kind of alluding to, but to be his best self in that, but still with the courage of not knowing that he knows
which way. I think that's it. You know, I think nobody disputes Boaz is a good man. He, you know, at best, he's really slow in following through. At worst, he's maybe, he's overwhelmed maybe by the scale of change that's needed in the community to welcome this woman in. The only way he can do it is to marry her. But that's unseemly, or could, is in danger of being seen as unseemly or is being resisted by the people because it's such a dramatic change in the law. And if we let this foreigner in, how many foreigners are going to come? So there's all, and it's just slow, but she gives him the space. Now, it's taken to an extent the risk of humiliation and degrading herself. That's the cost to this vulnerable woman of finding a home in this place. But it's, and I'm uncomfortable in saying it, this is what it seems to have taken to draw the best out of Boaz, to make him finally do what he knows he has to do, that he has been reluctant to do up to this point. Amazing risk she takes. Amazing risk. Because if he doesn't, all the deception in the world won't get over the fact the news gets out. She's pregnant. The news gets out. Oh, she was on the threshing room floor. Where we thought she was a woman of good character, now we know she's fulfilled every stereotype of Moabite women. Sorry. You can say?
Well, he, so far, has not risen to the occasion. Oh. Maybe I can get someone else to take care of him.
Yep. He is still stepping there. I think there's more of a determination at this point now, and I think we can either say he's hoping that the other relative will step in, or else he's saying, I'm going to do this, and we're going to do it absolutely properly, and we'll make sure we'll expose this guy for what he is, and then I can marry you free of encumbrance. We can, I think either is possible.
He could rise to the occasion now.
He could. However, he could be open to a legal challenge. If the town accepts their marriage, he could be open to a legal challenge for the land without dealing with the other relative who hasn't actually appeared in the story yet. He's coming next. Yeah?
I was just going to say that.
Great
minds. Somebody else has a claim.
Yeah, somebody else has a legal claim to the land. And it could get messy.
Let's keep going. We're nearly done. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. This is the other relative who has a prior claim to the land. Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And they did so. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so, but if you will not, tell me, so I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. Oh, that's great. I will do it, says the unnamed relative. So, effectively, what we've got here is we have Boaz and the unnamed relative. And they have a relationship because both of them are related to Elimelech, who is Naomi's deceased husband. So they need to sort this out between them about the transfer of land, because they are both related to Elimelech. Now, they have Mahlon, who was one of their children, who was married to Ruth and died before they had children. So the line of the succession of land, he died, so the land couldn't travel this way. Because of that, it had to go up to here. The transfer of inheritance is up here. He is the closer relative, so he is ultimately responsible in the first place. Where will the transfer happen? How will the transfer happen? And he wants to do it legally and visibly in front of the elders and in front of the town. And the guy says, of course, I'll redeem the land. It will add to my holding. It'll, adds to my wealth. Then cleverly Boaz says, oh, by the way, on the day that you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Mark that sentence, by the way. In order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the guardian redeemer said, maybe not. I can't redeem it because it might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself, I can't do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off a sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I've also acquired Ruth the Moabite. Now, here's the crucial sentence. Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or his hometown. Today you are witnesses. His intention is not just to acquire a maidservant. Earlier in the text, she moves from being a foreigner. The text refers to her as a foreigner. Then it refers to her as a maidservant. And here, she is being referred to as wife. This is the key transformation. She's not just a servant that he acquires with the land, a piece of property that comes with the land. He is looking to acquire her, to take her as his wife and fold her in to the family of Israel, this foreigner. And he says, you're witnesses of this? Now, on the turn of the page here, the people could say, hold on a minute, we're not happy with that. Because if the other relative, he refuses to do it because he knows, well, you know, she's young enough to have children. If we have a boy with her, then that boy will inherit Elimelech's land. And he can't be an Israelite because he's born of a foreign woman. Therefore, the land is passing out into foreign hands. We can't let that happen. And if my children die, that boy might actually inherit my estate as well. And it passes out of our holding. In Ireland, I'm sure it's the same here. When farms are being traded, it's very, very, very important that you sell it to the right person. If you're a Protestant farmer on the border of Northern Ireland, you do not sell your land to a Catholic farmer. because that's giving up some of the land, some of the identity, some of the property to the others. And there's some of that, I think, in the anonymous man's concern. So you'll be witnesses to what? A scandal? We will not. But the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses." That's an amazing statement. We are witnesses to this foreign woman being treated as your wife, being treated as family in Israel for the sake of this transfer of land. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May Ruth become like two of our great matriarchs. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman. May your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. If you want any more sexual scandal, read the story of Tamar and Judah. There are children present, so we won't do it this afternoon. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms. Whoa, hold on a second, Naomi. It's not your baby. But they've taken the baby from Ruth and handed it to Naomi, as if it was Naomi's child. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nashon. Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David. What do you notice in the list of names? What do you notice in the list of names? Actually, better question is, what do you notice is missing in the list of names?
Yeah.
Well, let me go back a bit. One of the things I asked you to notice, and you obviously didn't.
No.
Look at verse 5 up there. Boaz, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property.
He's named Obed instead of Nalon, right?
Well, two things. Ruth was married to Mahlon. Boaz acquires Ruth. She becomes his wife to preserve the name of Mahlon and Elimelech, therefore, in the history of Israel. But actually, Mahlon is gone. And Boaz, through his act of kindness eventually, steps in. And the other thing that I just find really interesting is the fact that the guy who could have been there, if he had acquired the land in the first place, not only is he not in the list, we don't even know what his name is. He is utterly forgotten because he found it impossible to do that act of kindness in response to the goodness of this woman that everybody knew about. He was more interested in economic advancement and economic security to the extent that he is utterly forgotten in the history of Israel. Utterly forgotten. Because his desire for economic advancement lasted not even for a generation. He disappears. But likewise, Boaz, through this act of kindness, and Ruth, through this act of extraordinary goodness, they're preserved in the line forever. We're still talking about them. Of course, in the book of Matthew, in the genealogy, of Jesus in the first chapter. There are five women mentioned or referred to, one of whom is Ruth. Her name as the foreigner is preserved in the history. So what's all this got to do with Brexit, or what's it all got to do with your own struggles in this part of the world? Let me skip on here. What has happened in this context is that these three interconnected laws, which didn't apply cleanly in any of those circumstances, so that it is quite easy, it's quite easy to write an alternative story in which Naomi falls into poverty and dies, and Ruth is ill-treated as a foreigner and disappears. It's very easy to see that happening. However, something happens in the story where these three things come together and adjustments are made so that these vulnerable people are folded back into the family. This, for me, is the summation, is the ultimate direction of travel for this story, where the application of the law, even if it's the law that Moses handed down, if in the application of the law of Moses it results in an unforeseen or an unintended unkindness for vulnerable people, you can't just shrug your shoulders and say that's an awful pity. But actually, the majority of people are covered. It just happens that there are people that fall outside the protection. In the story of Ruth, when that happens, the law is adjusted always to shelter vulnerable people. So you have the more obvious members of the nation covered over by the law, protected by the law. And this vulnerable stranger, this vulnerable foreigner who was outside the protection of the law, we're sorry, we'll do our best for you, we know you're good, you know, you can, you know, we'll applaud your kindness, we'll let you glean. Instead, what Boaz engineers is an incredibly daring thing. He stands in front of the people of the town and says, I think we need to look to the intent of the law of Moses, not its direct application. Its intent, if we read it through the lens of kindness, its intent was to provide shelter for vulnerable people. These three laws we talk about, their intent is to provide shelter for vulnerable people. We have discovered an exception. We need to adjust our law to extend its protection to the foreigner. Because the purpose of the law is not to define who's in or who's out. The purpose of the law is to provide that kind of shelter and protection for whoever needs it. And when the law bumps up against the needs of vulnerable people, the law changes. Last week, just one comment. Last week, Nadia Boltz-Weber was here and we were chatting about this outside of the session, and Nadia made a fantastic comment about, and she said, all of these laws about being concerned about your neighbor, that's because God knew you were such a danger to your neighbor, he needed to put in place laws to protect them from you. One final comment and then come to in Hebrew tradition, in the Hebrew, in biblical Hebrew, the Hebrew word for the shining majesty, glory, transcendence of God is the word Shekinah. Maybe some of you will have heard that word. And Hebrew is what's called a consonantal language. We don't really know how it's pronounced. We we have an idea, so all we have are the consonants, and we kind of fill in the vowels around it. But the three principal consonants of the word for the glory of God is the word, are S, K, and N. The three principal consonantal letters in the word, the Hebrew word for neighbor, unsurprisingly, are S, K, N. That the glory of God and your neighbor in Hebrew have the same root. And if you read the Ten Commandments, they are in Exodus 20, they are structured in the same way. They begin with, I am the Lord your God. The very last Hebrew word in the list of the Ten Commandments is, you guessed it,
neighbor.
They bracket the Ten Commandments. God and neighbor. And so Jesus says, love the Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. And this, I think, is what Boaz is doing, is a recognition. God didn't intend law to be the thing which defined the ins and the outs. God intended law for kindness. And where it results in an unintended unkindness, change the law, even if it's the law of Moses. Or maybe even the law of the land. Sorry, I've been talking too long.
No, I just want to make a comment. I think it's Walter Brueggemann who was talking about Ruth in some book I read. And he was saying it was a challenge to, the book of Ruth is a challenge to the chosen people and their conception of God, God being just for them. And if you trace the lineage of David back to a Moabite woman, it challenges that whole, you know, by that?
Yeah. I do completely.
But it's taking God to task in one sense and saying, God is bigger than the Israelites. God is bigger and much more inclusive of other peoples and other cultures. In this case, specifically the Moabites.
Forgive me for those of you who were at the last session on this, but a lot of scholars, it's very hard to date the book of Ruth, but it's generally taken to be a book written after they returned from exile. So after Jerusalem has been destroyed by the Babylonians, they're carted off into Babylon in exile. And then Babylon is destroyed and they're allowed to return. This is where I think this gets really sharp in both our national context. When they come back to the land, it's a mess. And nothing has changed from the destruction all those years ago. Even though the people coming back had all these great visions of everything being restored. So they come back and there are people there. The people who've always been there, there are people who've moved in, and then there are various groups of people returning back in. And so inevitably, in the rebuilding of the nation, there are all sorts of competing ideas for how this should be done. Absolutely, I make no apologies for saying it. In question is, how do we make Israel great again? So they have MEGA. There is a stream of political aspiration at the time associated with people with the school of prophets of Ezekiel and some of the others who say, we went wrong as a nation because we lost true faith. We no longer practice the faith that is our inheritance. So stop building your homes. Stop building national infrastructure. Before we do anything to rebuild this nation, if we're going to be great again, we need to rebuild the temple. Rebuilding the temple is what will make us great again. Then you have a stream of tradition, a political aspiration aligned with people like Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezra and Nehemiah are saying, actually, do you know where we went wrong? We went wrong when we allowed all the foreigners in. And the way we make this nation great again is to ethnically purify it. And so they passed a law during Ezra's time, enforced rigorously by both Ezra and Nehemiah, with great violence. Read the last chapter of the book of Nehemiah. With real violence, they said, any of you men who have married foreign wives, divorce them. Don't care how long you've been married to them, how many children you've got by them. If you have a foreign wife, divorce them, send them away. Marry a good Jewish woman. The way to make the nation great again is to purify us ethnically. Because that's the way you belong. You belong religiously. You follow the faith of our fathers. Or you are ethnically one of us. We're not allowing any mixing, any foreigners here. That's how we make. And the book of Ruth comes in as a counter narrative to that and says, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Let's look back over our history here. Our great King David was of mixed blood.
Yeah.
Our great king, the greatest king in our history, the great songwriter of the Psalms, his blood wasn't pure. So ethnically, he doesn't belong to us. And yet, he's our great king. And so I think the book of Ruth is challenging this issue of belonging. How do you belong to this place and this people? Ruth challenges it because it's not just about saying, you know, oh, she's a good foreigner, so we make a little bit of space over here. It's actually about how do we find the generosity, not just to make a kind of enclave for the good foreigners. It's about saying, can we find the kindness and generosity to open membership to people who are different to us? Is that what might make us great? That's what we're wrestling with back home. How do you belong here? What is necessary for us to be a great nation? Is it economics? Is it what is it?
Isn't that the same question that's going on, like with Palestine and Israel, and it goes way back to, you know, the ancestry of Israel, and also, I mean, when I read Muslim theology, it's also has so much to do with this same concept, but yet they can't come together. We find it hard in dialogue, even.
Yep. Again, in one of the previous session, we drew this triangle, which is Egypt, Pharaoh at the top and slaves at the bottom. And everybody in that system, rigid hierarchical system, where the one above exploits everything below, everybody in that system struggles. Everybody from the top to the bottom is stressed and anxious. And in the Bible story, one person manages to escape the triangle and wanders out significantly into the wilderness and meets a bush. And the bush talks. And the bush tells this murderer with a speech impediment, go back into the triangle and talk to the guy at the top, and said, the bush told me that you're to let us go. And, you know, the whole point of that is, it is ludicrous. It is ridiculous. It can't be explained. This triangle must be dismantled, or you need to get out of it. And God is encountered in this wilderness at this bush. Miraculously, it happens. And that bottom tier of all sorts of peoples manage to get out, and they get away into the wilderness, and they meet God, not at the bush this time, but at the big mountain. And what do? From the off, They build a big system of laws. There are, you know, there are people who do this and people who do that, and there's people who then make a mess of things. And this is always that human tendency to build these. And it's always a call out. It's always a call. So when Jesus comes, Jesus says, look, come and follow me. Take my burden upon you. Because mine is easy and light. And you'll find rest for your souls here. You don't need to be stressed in this hierarchical system of laws and rules and ins and outs. And come out from there. And there's a different way of being in the world. It's all, we wrestle with it all the time. Our countries wrestle with it. And the risk of opening up membership and opening up our borders, that terrifies us because we don't know. We will close our borders in defiance of the evidence sometimes because of the fear of extending our, changing our laws in favor of vulnerable people who are fleeing their countries because of famine or war, sometimes wars that we've started, and are prosecuted.
That latest horrible thing with us, with the separation of children from their parents, every time you heard it talked about, the reason was we're following the law.
Yeah. Change the law. If the liturgical coupling of Ruth and the Exodus, the Sinai story, is to be read in that as that lens of kindness through which to view the law, if the law is there to ensure kindness in the land, then as we are pushing the boundaries of the law, we are always finding people who fall outside its protection. Extend the protections. That to me seems to be the message of the scriptures. That where your tradition, where your laws rub up against vulnerable people, choose people over law. Choose people over law. I just want to make, I'm not going to make any comment other than what's there. Briefly, we don't have time to talk about the borders we've crossed and the journey, but a couple of things I think from a practical point of view, particularly when we're in positions of conflict against those who are different or think differently to us about how the country should be run or whatever, who belongs and who doesn't. We need to be careful about our language, because at some stage we are going to have to walk back from the harsh language we've used about one another. And so if we stereotype even those we believe are wrong in this debate, if we use harsh language, you know, whether it's about your president or our prime minister or the Tories back home, we use the harsh language. If we get what we want, we're going to have to walk back from that language at some stage. Better not to have to do that. Better not to say those things in the first place. Better to act kindly even towards our enemies, so we don't have to walk back from the harsh language. Secondly, to avoid the creation of stereotypes and the process of demonization that comes along with that. And as I said at the beginning, how easily and inevitably we slip into violence against people we have stereotyped and demonized. We need to understand those who are different from us. In a context like here, all sides have to consume different news sources in order to understand why those we are with whom we differ think the way they do. We can't just tell them they're wrong. We need to understand what is fueling this. And one of the ways of doing that is consuming news sources that we wouldn't naturally move to. Practice attention. Anybody who was here remember that three-line poem from Mary Oliver? I probably can't myself, but pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. And as somebody, I mean, in part it's paying attention to wonder, being astonished and telling about it. But as somebody pointed out to me after our session, and I'd never thought of it this way before, it's also paying attention to atrocity and being astonished at how we could stoop so low and reminding people this is not us at our best. This is not who we are. Pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it. And believe in the transformational power of kindness. It is a deeply subversive act in a culture of violent language and extremes. Kindness is one of the most subversive acts we can do. To act with kindness, particularly towards those who are different, particularly towards those who are our enemies, is deeply subversive and transformative of the atmosphere. We could spend a lot of time together talking about that, but I've gone on too long. I said I was going to end with another story song. Same guy. This one is called Indiscriminate Act of Kindness. And again, I hope you can see the words. Just sit back, let this story and the music flow over you, and I think hopefully prayerfully stir your soul to acts of kindness.
She came in from the cold, dropped her luggage by, slipped the concierge in the eye, said I need a room for the night, but I don't got no money, would you take babe in kind? He said it's alright, I really you can share my make the bed in the morning, and I'll do fine. You can change in the bathroom, hang your clothes on the line. A tear came to her eyes, she thought, how could he be so kind? How could he be so kind? How could he be so kind? She sat down on the bed with a needle. He said, I hate to see you bleed. Just spent your warm time and sit with you till you're dry. She started to cry, said, why? Considering an indiscriminate act of kindness. Considering an indiscriminate act of kindness. Considering an indiscriminate act of kindness. She was cold turkey, he was cold at her heart. I was ruined by mine. This was never in my plans. I dreamed no man loved me. Together we'd see the world. Somehow I lost myself among the insults they heard. I'm sure you're a wonderful one. And someday there will surely be someone. So just relax, it's important that you come. She said, how is it you can see past me as I am? Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Consider it an indiscriminate act of kindness. Like you play. concierge, curl on the settee. Said what you did for me, it's hard for me to believe. I was just doing what was right. No one that knows love could leave out there on such a night. If you could help someone bear this in mind, and consider it early and discriminate act of kind. Consider it early and discriminate act of kind. Consider it early and discriminate act of kind. Consider it.
Closing. All we've produced a range of resources, Bible studies, conversation material on the Book of Ruth. They're all available for free to download off the Coramila website. This is the material here. And if it's of use to you individually or in your church settings, we'd be delighted if you could use them. And I would be particularly delighted if you did use some, that you dropped me an email or a message on the site just to say this worked, this didn't work, or this was useful, this wasn't. And the aim is that we'll finish this project by Easter of next year, and then we'll rewrite this material, taking out the Brexit elements of it and make it much more generic for all sorts of settings. And if you preach the lectionary, on that website, spiritualityofconflict.com, there are lectionary resources on reading the Sunday gospel through the lens of conflict and conflict through the lens of the gospel text. Like, we're in year B at the moment, but there's all sorts of resources online there for how to use the gospel texts, or suggestions, ideas, and prayers, and so on. If you are interested in continuing a conversation about any of this, you can get me. Coramila is the organization. That's our Twitter handle, and that Crooked Shore is mine. You can find any, if you, I think I'm probably the only Crooked Shore online, so you'll find, it's an old Irish name for the town I live in, Bangor. I've anglicized it. Crookedshore.com is my blog, and there's some materials on there as well. And you can get me on Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, at crookedshore.com. And I'd be very happy to continue a conversation. Other than that, I hope you are inspired to indiscriminate acts of kindness in your own setting, and by it, to trust that we'll see the transformation of our, of both our contexts, both our countries, our nations. Blessings.
Thank you.
Thank you.